Welcome to Beer Stories for Private Equity. Join us for our weekly happy hour, tapping into 27 years of PE experience, one pint at a time. Beer Stories for Private Equity is powered by Monogram Group.
On today's show, we're excited to be joined by Charlie Gifford, one of the founders and a senior partner of New Heritage Capital.
And for Monogram Group, here's your host, Scott Markman.
Please fasten your seatbelts.
One of the exciting things about this episode of Beer Stories for Private Equity is that Charlie is the first guest that prior to 10 minutes ago I have not met before, which is in all sincerity kind of cool because we have leaned into our clients, former clients, whatever. I've been on Charlie's email list for a number of years, actually. So I see their communications and always thought it was very impressive and really well done and very consistent. And that's how I knew about New Heritage Capital. So it's really exciting that Charlie has been willing to join us on the show. So thanks, Charlie, for that.
No, it's my pleasure and grateful to be included. You say it's cool. I hope you feel that it's cool at the end of a half hour conversation as well. And I guess we'll find that out.
It'll be on you, all on your shoulders, not on mine. I'm just
my narrow shoulders. We'll see what we can do.
All right. So got your undergraduate at Denison, and then you came to Chicago for B school at Kellogg. A couple of fond memories of the beloved Chicago.
Well, if I didn't say the day I got married in Kenilworth Union Church in 1997, I'd be in trouble. So I'd have to put that on the top of the list. But after marriage, moved to Boston, worked in banking in a startup, and then went back to Chicago in 97 to start two fantastic years at Kellogg. Another highlight would that be of my eldest being born in Evanston in 1999. But as a provincial Northeasterner with a high emphasis on the city of Boston, where I've lived most of my life, I do have a soft spot for Chicago. It is such a dynamic and cosmopolitan city that I've had lots of fond memories of, including probably my closest friends in the world who I met during my 2 years at Kellogg. It was a great group of people, learned a lot and made a lot of great connections.
So I am also an Eastern native, as listeners I hope have picked up. I'm from Baltimore. So at the end of this, Charlie, we will talk Patriots because I can't resist. So retrace a few steps after B school about how you landed in private equity, because people don't just back into going into private equity.
I asked my father, who is a very close confidant and fun fact was my best man in my wedding in Kenilworth Union Church back 27 years ago. And I remember asking him going into business school because I wanted to use it as a springboard to think about a career change. He was a banker. And I said, if you had to do it over again, what would you do? And he said, without hesitation, if you like the world of corporate finance, and I had a little bit of a banking background at Smith Barney, he said, you should really look into private equity. And I said, why is that? He said, it really encapsulates everything of what pure capitalism is. It's obviously finance, but it's also sales, it's organizational behavior, it's human resources, it's about building consensus within your organization and then trying to have that type of consensus move forward in a way that you're built earning the confidence of others, not only investors, but also management teams. Okay. So I said, well, that sounds kind of cool. So in between years of business school, I was fortunate enough to get a summer internship at our predecessor fund back in Boston. Had a great experience, ended up getting a job on the last day of my summer internship, which led to a very fulfilling and fun second year of business school, and then joined my two partners at Old Co. in August 2nd of 99, and somebody told me that means our 25th anniversary is coming up, which makes me feel immensely, immensely old and gives me pause, but it is what it is.
So you mentioned Old Co. And again, I don't know anything about Old Co. What was Old Co. since there was a new Co.?
Old Co. is Heritage Partners, started in the early 90s. I joined in the late 90s in 99. They raised Fund 3, which is an $850 million vehicle. it ended up that the three founding partners desired to retire and move on. There wasn't going to be a Fund 4. But my two partners now, Mark Charoff and Nikki Norris, and I saw an opportunity. And Old Coast started lower middle market but moved to larger deals. But we always felt like, and I'll talk a little bit about our strategy in a second, but we thought that the most appealing part of our target audience was in the lower middle market. And back in the day, we left in 06 to form New Heritage Capital to hang our shingle, did it on a deal-by-deal basis. It turned out incredibly well, some interesting times and stories along the way. It was a tremendous learning experience from Old Co to New Co, and the one commonality is how we structure our deals.
One of the things I noticed to get ready for our conversation is that your firm is a generalist firm. What you invest in and the sectors and all that seems to be broader than a lot of what I hear about today, which is, well, we have these two or three niches. Why? You know, again, there's nothing accidental in private equity, so why?
We strongly believe, I'm going to mix in some more advice from the old man, which is find something that you're really, really good at, whether that's providing a service or developing a product, and be maniacal about serving your customer base. Provide better product, better service, provide better customer service, et cetera. Do your best to really be focused on meeting the needs of a select group of customers. So find out what your total addressable market is, how big is it, and then figure out who you want to serve. And I asked him that question from the standpoint of looking at businesses to invest in, but it also very much holds true about how we run our business. And our business, instead of falling in line with all the other 1,000-plus equity sponsors out there, because everybody says, well, you have to be an industry specialist if you're going to kind of win the confidence of investors and win the confidence of business owners. Instead of being vertically focused, Scott, we're what we call more horizontally focused. Okay. And what I mean by that is that our focus has been, even at Old Co and at New Co, which again, we started New Heritage Capital in 2006, is to find and partner with middle market founder owners that have yet to raise institutional equity capital. And so they come to the table in search of a corporate finance solution, but everything they see is an 80-20 leverage buyout. And a lot of business owners will say, I'm not interested in an 80-20 leverage recap. I'm too young to retire. I don't want to be somebody's employee. And I candidly don't want to take direction from a 28-year-old, very bright person that graduated from a top business school and are going to come in here and tell me how to run my business. And so what I just described was this concept of private equity partnership, right? So private equity guys come in or girls come in and talk to business owners and say, we're going to be your best partner. We're going to come in. But, oh, yeah, by the way, the quid pro quo of capitalism is I give you a lot of money, and in return, I get control. So that's the way the world works. And so these business owners come to the table thinking that they're going to, because they have a liquidity need, right, to either diversify net worth or to cash out inactive shareholders that have a different risk profile. But behind this all is this maniacal CEO who says, again, too young to retire, don't want to be somebody's employee. I believe the best way to invest, I want to invest and reinvest back into my business because I know my business over the next 3 to 5 years are going to be the most exciting 5 years in the history of the business. And so it's that kind of deal dynamic that we are always in search of. And with our private IPO structure, which is peculiarly a registered trademark. Yep.
I just for those that are watching on YouTube, I just circled an R'd the parallel what Charlie just said.
One thing, we're never bound by conventional norms, right? So we're not afraid to do different things. But it's the idea about providing the benefits of going public to private companies without going public. That is to get material liquidity. You don't have to sell control. You can keep control of the voting stock and the board. And you get access to growth capital. So we just inherently believe, Scott, that the most intuitive way to invest our investors' capital is to find those founder owners that are looking for something other than an 80-20 leverage recap. And with our structure, we provide the liquidity of a change of control transaction, up to 80% of the value in the business in day one. But we give them 3 of the 5 board seats and up to 50% of the equity on the exit if they hit their expected growth case. So again, not trying to be all things to all people. Back to the old man's advice. It's about servicing a select group of people and bringing a product that is different from everyone else. Somebody much smarter than me said, sometimes it's better to be the only than the best. And I'm not sure we're the only people to do it, but I do think we're the only ones that really focus on that branding of being a differentiated corporate finance solution provider to private businesses.
If we were in the same room, I would hug you because you actually use the word brand or branding. And I want to tell you what I mean by that. It isn't logos. It isn't emails. It's a brand. We define brand at the agency as DNA. Brand is the everything. And you just described your everything succinctly in 3 minutes or so. You described what is your mission, what are you trying to accomplish, why, how you go about doing it, how you communicate it. That's fucking brand. That's how we define brand and how we whip religion on our clients is what you just said. And very, 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 very few private equity people would ever think that way, let alone articulate it.
Yeah. I told you earlier that I don't like being on conversations where one person just says, I totally agree with you, and I agree with you. That's boring. But I do agree with you, because at the end of the day, private equity, you know, you go back to the days of Henry Kravis. You know, he used to have this adage from a private equity marketing standpoint. Now, granted, it was a different day back in the kind of late 80s, early 90s, but, you know, he once quipped that, you know, the best form of private equity marketing was having great returns and letting them speak for yourself. Keep your head down, do everything you can to return above average returns for your investors, on to the next. Now that worked for KKR back in the day, but again, it's a different day and age right now. And in the market that we find ourselves in, you have to find a different lane. And I have to tell you, I love what we do. I love what we do because it's the most intuitive way to invest equity capital. Like, instead of doing leverage buyouts, we do leverage buy-ins. We're coming in and buying into the vision of the founder. And to us, that's everything. But if you just come in and try to differentiate yourself by claiming you're smarter than the next guy, I mean, hell, and the ante to play the private equity game is to be obviously very capable and bright. But if you marry that with a differentiated solution, one that really is a more of a true partnership and not a private equity partnership by common terms that we know today, we really think that is an interesting differentiator. And at the end of the day, we're not trying to do every deal out there. We're just trying to define the 1, 2, or 3 platforms a year that are run by those maniacal CEOs that are looking for something different.
Okay.
Can I say one more thing about the whole brand?
Yep, yep.
And this occurred to me. You know, you, like I, are seeing this proliferation of lists. And the most famous one.
Inc. magazine, right? Founder friendly.
Can I rant? I don't know if this is the appropriate place to go on a rant. And, you know, we've been on that
rant. Rant away.
You know, back in the day, you didn't have to pay for it. Now, you know, everybody pays for it. I feel like a lot of private equity firms, their whole marketing strategy is, how do I find my way on more lists that I can tell that I tell my LPs that I'm on this list and this list and I'm in this top 10 and this top 25 and this top 500 or whatever it is, as opposed to having a true differentiator and really focusing on building your brand, not only in the minds of your investors, but also your target audience. So yeah, it's great to be on a list, but I just feel like there have been more and more of these lists. I think we can reach our target audience in different ways than just having to be on a list or so. We don't lose a lot of sleep over it. I mean, it's nice to be on it, but at the end of the day, I think there are better tools and strategies that you can employ to achieve your strategy of differentiation.
I do want to give you folks props for doing your communications cadence and consistency and sophistication better than a vast majority of your brethren. And again, we've had nothing to do with it. I'm a recipient because I got on your mailing list one day. But I want you to give a window into our listeners as to the how and the why. What value do you see from that? Because I just see your firm doing it really damn well.
I'm grateful for you saying that. The way we think about it is, we espouse this belief. Actually, what I learned at Kellogg about this rule of eight. And the rule of eight states that for a consumer to reach for a new item along the aisles of a grocery store, they have to
eight impressions.
Eight unique impressions. So it has to hit them once, and they're like, oh, that whatever. Hits again, like, I think I've heard that before. Third time, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth. And then they're finally in the aisles of the grocery store, and they reach for the product on the shelf. So compare that to private equity and the way our market has become more and more efficient. The day of waiting for the phone to ring, which doesn't happen anymore, or the email to hit your inbox with a new deal, I would posit that if that's your strategy, you're going to be facing an uphill battle. So what we do, again, we have this unique kind of structure called the private IPO. And we want it, one, to be synonymous with the name heritage. We want people to think about us for recaps of founder owners that are looking for something other than a full sale. But what I always tell my kids to do is similar to what we try to do and how we think about our market, which is put yourself in the minds of the investment banker that is building the buyer's list. Mm-hmm. And some of my closest friends in the world are the ones I've met on the other side of the table over the last 25 years, many of which live in the city of Chicago. But let's face it, Scott, there are thousands and thousands of people they can put on that list. Why are they going to put New Heritage Capital on the list? And so I'm a firm believer that despite a lot of these guys and girls being very close friends of mine, I can't just hope. Hope is not a strategy. You can't just hope people remember you when they're putting pen to paper or keys to keyboard. So how do you do it? Well, you can't call them every week because that will have the unintended consequence of pissing them off. You can't email them every week because after a while, they're just not going to read everything you send. But if you find different ways to make different impressions on top of the phone calls and the Zoom calls and the meetings and all that stuff, we do. It's the ancillary activities like starting our silly little podcast, Middle Market Musings, which we started 3 years ago. I can't believe we're still doing it, but the feedback has been overwhelming. And then on top of that, we do these little LinkedIn misses. You know, everybody, not to give away the special sauce, but everybody uses LinkedIn the same way. I bought this company, I sold this company, I hired this person, blah, blah, blah. You know, LinkedIn is the easiest way to think about it. You know, New Heritage Capital has, I don't know, 2,000 followers. But in my silly follower universe, it's like 6,000. Why? I can't understand, but it is what it is. I have, you know, that people are interested in what I might have to say. But where you're seen and where we've had success is not building the brand necessarily on the corporate firm side. It's actually using my platform to put forth video snippets about market conditions or the private IPO and the benefits of doing it to hit the investment banker, hopefully, when they're putting pen to paper or key to keypad. Now, mind you, me being the face to the firm gives my partners immense pause, but it is what it is, and it seems to be working. And until it doesn't work, we'll continue doing so.
It's interesting you say that about LinkedIn because we follow the same strategy. So my personal profile is a little bit the tip of the spear. Now, on a personal level, it rubs me the wrong way to do that because the firm is called Monogram for a reason and not Markman. From day one, when I was just a guy around a coffee table hanging my shingle, my parents owned a business. It was named after my father, and God bless him, and they built a nice little business, retired, and that was that. But I grew up with that. I didn't want that when I was in my dad's position. I'm not criticizing it. It's just not what I wanted. So if I've run away from this direct association with the agency being me, being synonymous, having said that, in 2024, it benefits the agency to have me be the tip of the spear. And it was part of the motivation to create the podcast was to put me out there as like a figurehead, even though candidly, I'm not comfortable with it because it's just, I'm a wee guy. I grew up playing team sports. We have one mantra in this agency, which is we win as a team, lose the team. That's it. There's nothing else. So for me to sit there and say, hey, dig me, I'm not comfortable with this, but I know business-wise it benefits. And that's exactly what you're saying.
Well, take that to the next step. Think about, is there an industry that has a better track record with succession than private equity. And you think about back in the day, you know, everybody, most of the firms that were starting out were named after people. And that's evolved because, you know, people, when they start, they want it to be bigger than themselves, right? And it's hard for it to be bigger than themselves when it's named after one person. Now, as we know, no breaking news here. There's some large egos in private equity, right? I think I can say that with a high degree of confidence.
I would never say that, ever.
A lot of class presidents, a lot of, it's like the, you know, U.S. House of Representatives. Now, maybe not that bad, but there are a lot of people with strong convictions and a lot of people that have high opinions of themselves, which is really complicates the whole piece of succession. I think it's made even harder when you name a firm after one person.
Yep. All right, we're going to pivot to the fun stuff. You've shared.
What do you mean? This has been fun the entire time.
No, even more fun.
Okay.
Even more
fun. All right.
You mentioned some things about your family, your kids at Northwestern. You met your wife in Chicago and got married in Kenilworth. What's the coolest place that you and the fam have traveled to in the last year and why?
I always tell my kids I work hard so I can drag them to different places around the world. Last year, we went to Deppler Farm in Iceland to try to see the Northern Lights, which is a super cool place. Part of Chad Pike, who used to run real estate for Blackstone, created these 8 or so lodges around the world. And they're called the 11 Experience because he wants to take it to the, not 1 to 10, but 11. And I'd say it's 11, both in terms of beauty and experience, but also cost. But it's a pretty spectacular place. Sadly, we were clouded out from seeing the Northern Lights. We also went with a bunch of friends. We went hiking along the coast of Croatia, starting Dubrovnik to Korčula to Hvar. I love the water in the Mediterranean. I like beaches, but that water is pretty spectacular. So those are two places that are on the hit list, although my wife is now planning a trip to go hug gorillas in the mountains of Rwanda later this year. So hopefully we're going
to
do that.
So my wife and I, 5 years ago, probably this week, went to Iceland to see the Northern Lights.
How'd you do?
We did.
Oh, cool.
We saw it, but I have to tell you that one of the probably two coldest moments of my life, and the air temp wasn't even that bad. It might've been 20 degrees, but the wind chill was probably 40 below. And the guide, you know, gets our camera out. He let me take a picture and you can see my wife and I, we're smiling, but I'm telling you, I just wanted to like rip someone's lungs out because it was so cold.
And it's that damp, it's the damp cold too, that just kind of like seeps into your bones.
Having said that, there's a photo on my phone of my wife and I from that trip. And it was when we were snowmobiling with, let's say, 6 other, you know, groups of 2 couples, whatever the case, and a guide on a glacier as far and wide as the eye could see. And it is the most unbridled joy, probably, experience of the last 20 years.
Super cool.
We are going to bring our convo to a conclusion with the most electric controversial question of the discussion, which is the one Boston sports legend you most want to have dinner with and why?
Alive or passed away?
Either or. So it could be Babe Ruth, who played for the Red Sox.
Sure. I think I'd say Ted Williams. I shook his hand at the 1999 All-Star Game when the Red Sox hosted at Fenway. And he had hands the size of a catcher's mitt, which I thought was really interesting. And he was known as a cantankerous old SOB.
Absolutely. He was a cantankerous young SOB.
Yeah. He was a pretty remarkable guy. And people forget how his career was interrupted at its pinnacle by serving in the military. You know, 406 is up there with the answers to the often asked question, what sporting record will stand the test of time? I think that's up there, and I think he'd be a pretty remarkable guy to meet.
Yeah, I mean, I've read stories about Ted Williams saying that, when he hit the ball, he could see the...
No, it was when the pitcher, when the ball was coming at him, supposedly, he could see by the rotation of the seams whether it was a cutter, a splitter, a changeup, fastball, curveball. He was also a huge outdoorsman, loved to fish, and that's absolutely something I enjoy doing as well. So that,
isn't in the Fishing Hall of Fame?
Yes.
The crazy thing about Ted Williams, during the years when he played, he was in one World Series, that was it. And then for a lot of those years, they kind of stunk.
Yeah.
It was sort of him and like a bad team, because that was during the heyday of the Yankees in the 50s.
Up to your point on Williams, you know, and reflecting back on your comment about the McCaskies, don't ever overestimate the importance of solid ownership in professional sports. I mean, people don't get lucky. They get lucky, but sports is, especially nowadays, I mean, it's turned into a business. And you talk to Redskins fans about how they feel about Josh Harris versus Daniel Snyder, or about how Knicks and Rangers fan feel about Charles Dolan. A lot of these people are just hard to root for. And I know I'm contradicting myself because I know the Rangers and the Knicks are on the upwards, but having solid owners that are treating these teams like a true business. I mean, look at the asset values. I mean, yeah, the media rights deals are what driving it primarily, but there are a lot of ancillary revenue that these teams can earn by bringing best practices to the table, and that's what a lot of them have done.
All right, sir, as I had hoped, this is a gob of fun. I really appreciate it. I love the convo, and I hope we can do it again.
Scott, it's been entirely my pleasure. Thank you for including me. Best of luck to you and your team, and look forward to staying in touch.
From all of us at Monogram Group, thanks for tuning in to Beer Stories for Private Equity,
Episode 10.
Don't forget to hit the subscribe button, and you'll be notified as we release new episodes. Please check out the show notes in the description from today's episode. Our email is podcast@monogramgroup.com. Feel free to email us with any comments or questions, and we'll try to answer them in our next episode.